What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends. John Krofcik, Larry Rifkin here, and we're trying to make you feel a little bit more comfortable in the world that's almost upon us, John. That's what we're doing. Well, people have to get ready. Look, when you go out, because you're such a flashy dresser, I mean, don't you spend some time getting ready to show yourself and strut in the world
right.
out there?
That's the world's the stage.
Yeah, it is. How come we treat it as if we're still behind the curtain? Why do we do that, John? And you know, it's great when you do a podcast because we can dress any which way that we want.
Podcast I've got jeans and radio. That's today. Great about podcast and
Isn't
radio.
Isn't it? Yeah. It's great. And do we sound informal or do we sound formal?
I used to wonder what people looked like behind the microphone, and I was kind of disappointed sometimes.
Well, I think that's why a lot of us got into radio, John. You know, the old got a face for radio. But then I went out onto television stage, and I just, bought up Noxzema, all the products I could, and threw them on and said, maybe this can disguise
it. No, you did well on TV. You were good.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Well, I got to tell you, there's a song that our band has been doing called Dancing in the Dark, Bruce Springsteen.
That's a good one, yes.
And when he said, you know, I'm looking in the mirror, and I'm really upset with my clothes, my hair, my face. He doesn't like anything about himself. How many of us feel that way at times?
That's true. There are days. Yes.
Yeah. Just say, I'm tired and bored with myself.
What happened?
I don't know. Well, Springsteen always gives voice to things we're thinking
Who's
about.
Who's that old man in the wind in the mirror?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, my goodness. Don't even go there. Well, today, John, we are going to be looking at the flip side of dysfunction in Washington.
Oh, boy.
And we're going to focus on where the action is. No, this is a positive story, really, John.
Because that's good.
We get frustrated. We look at some of the gamesmanship, the partisanship that goes on in Washington, and we say, is this ever going to change? And is there an antidote to this anywhere? And what I'm so thrilled about with this podcast is that rather than trying to make it up or pretend, we really have real life examples of the fact that on the local level, there's a lot of energy to solve a lot of problems that we have in America, despite the dysfunction in state capitals and in our nation's capital.
You're absolutely right. I mean, that's where you can make the change. And I think that's where people are figuring out that the change has got to be made from the grassroots in your small towns.
Well, how many times have we seen it, even in our state, where we've got this council of governments and we've got this group of municipalities, and it doesn't matter whether Democrats or Republicans control these organizations, they work together. Yep. And when you really think about it on the local level, John, why does anybody need to have a D or an R after their name?
Yeah, they really shouldn't. I don't even think they should run elections that way at the local level. In fact, I even wonder at the national level if we shouldn't get rid of the D's and R's, but especially at the local level, it should make a difference.
Well, it may surprise you because I think for those of us who live in the state that we live in, virtually all of the local elections are partisan. But across the country, I think the number I last saw was that about 70% of them are nonpartisan.
Wow.
Isn't that great?
Yeah, that's incredible.
So it's all about the individual.
Right.
They have to really prove themselves. But the other thing that's going on the local level is cities are getting together horizontally. They're getting together with hospitals, educational groups, nonprofits like the United Way and their community foundations, and they're working together. They're rolling up their sleeves, and they're saying, let's get something done, whether it be in the arts, infrastructure, whether it be in how we remake our economy or finance local projects. Let's not look to Washington or our state capital for the answers.
Boy, I think that's a great idea. I wish this state would start doing stuff like that because
I think there are some communities. I mean, let's look. We live in Connecticut. We talk about that all the time. we have to live somewhere, so we live
true.
In Connecticut. But you look at New Haven. They work together often with their Chamber of Commerce, their foundation, the New Haven Area Foundation, and Yale University is involved in so many projects in New Haven. And that's an example of what we're talking about, where it's not just the local government that's trying to solve problems, but it's institutions that aren't going to go anywhere. Now, look, Yale University, as much as they have been recruited, and I remember where the governor of Florida said, well, Connecticut's such an inhospitable place. Why don't you come down here? I think they couldn't tear all the ivy off of the walls
and bring it
down there. You know, so they're staying. And they've been since, what, 1650?
Right.
So they're not going anywhere. So they said, well, if we're going to be here, let's help to solve the problems. Yeah. Because don't forget, the less inviting and livable, say, a New Haven, Connecticut is, when they're in competition with Cambridge, Massachusetts, and many other desirable places, they're going to attract fewer of the great
You're
students.
You're absolutely right. It's to their advantage to have a clean
and good and exciting environment. They have to.
You're absolutely
right. So it's very practical. So whether it's Pittsburgh, which remade itself from an old mill city to something that's quite new and dynamic, or Indianapolis or Chattanooga, on and on, the great thing about this podcast is you're going to learn about what is being called the new localism, how cities can thrive in the age of populism. John, what's really exciting is that we're looking at the same dynamic of what it was that we were expressing in the 2016 election about frustration, grievance, and anger, really, about things not getting done. And that's still going on in Washington, where there's still this hyper-partisanship. But that same level of concern and grievance is being turned on the local level into action and solving problems. Now, that's the flip side of what we see and hear about most often.
Well, that's if that's happening, that's a great thing. I'm anxious to listen to this because I think that's a wonderful thing.
Absolutely, and it really is going on because Jeremy Nowak and Bruce Katz, from their various vantage points, have been studying urban environments for a very long time. And so this is something that they've been noticing, but now it's really coming into view. Bruce Katz is with the Brookings Institution, a very respected think tank, and he and Jeremy Nowak wrote this book, The New Localism. And I think people are going to be very, very pleased to hear that while America may seem to be grinding to a halt on some basis, that locally that's not the case. And thankfully, there's some level of government and networks that are working in tandem and working very well to solve problems.
Well, let's listen to this.
Absolutely. So, on America Trends, welcome to the new localism. With us on the line is Bruce Katz. He's the co-author of a book called The New Localism, How Cities Can Thrive in the Age of Populism. There are a lot of people, Bruce, who are very concerned about the performance of government, particularly on those levels that we seem to focus on much more than others. That means the federal government and, to some degree, the state government. But local government, I think most of us consider it to be reliable and in touch with our basic needs, but you tell us it's really a vibrant form of government today, and there's so much going on locally that we really should pay more attention to.
Well, what we're saying in this book is that there's a new philosophy and practice of problem solving, not just in the United States, but around the world. When you think of the hard challenges that face societies, whether it's competitiveness or inclusive growth or even climate change, what we're seeing is a lot of the solutions are bottom-up rather than top-down. They're coming from cities and counties. They're being driven by networks and sectors of public, private, civic leaders and institutions, not by government alone,
mm-hmm.
because cities are really networks. And we're seeing interdisciplinary responses rather than the compartmentalized or bureaucratic responses of, say, a Department of Transportation to congestion or a Department of Housing around just housing or homelessness. So, you know, cities and counties have enormous amounts of power that just don't derive from the federal or state level. They have market power. They have civic power. And more they're deploying it in novel and innovative ways. And we think this increasingly is going to be the way that societies function going forward?
Well, one of the differences, not necessarily in every situation that you look at in your book, but we have these nonpartisan elections often, and they're so much closer to the action, and they're working, as you tell us, with universities, medical centers, business interests, labor, and they're coming together to form new alliances and more solutions.
Yeah, very much. I think at the city level and at the county level, you get rewarded for pragmatism, affirmative, energy. You get rewarded for solutions, not for obstruction. at the federal level or the state level, which have been hijacked by partisanship, a lot of the focus is, are you wearing a red shirt or a blue shirt? And are you adhering to ideology or to the party line? And so we see two different kinds of Americas emerging, really, which is these higher levels of government, which in theory have the power, and these cities and counties and metropolitan areas, which are actually doing the hard business of moving the country forward. And we think increasingly, power is going to belong to the problem solvers. And if we do enough of the problem solving, it'll become infectious and hopefully, begin to reform these dysfunctional levels of government.
Do you think that's possible? I know you share with us the notion that many of these cities and this new localism does permeate and does go from one community to another as they begin to talk to each other, and they're not really divided, Democrat or Republican. What are you getting done in your community, and how are you doing it? And I see it even where we live. So tell us, can this bottom-up approach then affect what's going on in state government and in the national government?
Well, I think the first thing that will happen is, when you're in a bottom-up world and a horizontal world where cities watch each other, observe each other, and try to adapt and adopt innovation, the first thing that will happen is we're going to capture, codify new models of, let's say, growth, governance, and finance. We focus on Pittsburgh as a model of growth over multiple decades, where they began to invest in centers of excellence around next-generation technology, robotics and autonomous vehicles and machine learning. We focus on Indianapolis as a new style of networked governance, collaborative governance across multiple sectors, corporations, universities, philanthropies. And we focus on Copenhagen as a new model of finance, where they're basically identifying, valuing, and then leveraging assets, land and buildings that the government owns, to invest in infrastructure. So I think what first will happen is we'll identify these new models, and then they will begin to be adapted and adopted quickly across cities. And then those cities will begin to go back to their higher levels of government and basically say with great specificity, we're doing the hard work down here. Could you change this policy or that policy to sort of leverage even more resources or have even greater effect? I think we're going to reverse engineer policy making at the national and state level, driven by local innovation and local problem solving. And that, in some ways, that's a true representative democracy. In theory, these higher levels of government are supposed to represent us, but they're more representative of their parties and ideologies than of the places they represent.
Do you think the movement to run for something, which seems to have caught the attention of so many average Americans, and even the Republicans just over the weekend trying to mobilize, and they're trying to mobilize not only at the federal level, but suggesting even if you're going to run for dog catcher, we want to give you some ideas and some approaches to this. Do you think that that is going to propel more activity where people say, I'm going to get involved, but I want to get involved on a local level, and that excitement and enthusiasm will populate even more of the activity of the new localism?
Well, I think people have choices, frankly. I mean, I think it's really heartening to know how many individuals, want to serve and have a transformative effect on the communities in which they live, but you don't necessarily need to run for public office to have that impact. You could be working at a major corporation or business association or a philanthropy or a university or environmental constituency. So I think at the local level, there are multiple ways to have impact in a networked world. And, the stories in our book basically show different stakeholders really taking leadership roles. Sometimes it was the mayor, like Greg Fisher in Louisville, mm-hmm. who really was able to pull together a cradle-to-career initiative that's having great effect. But in, you know, in Pittsburgh, it really was the philanthropic community. In Indianapolis, it was the corporate community. I think the great thing about new localism is it really opens up a much greater field for impact across multiple sectors.
How much of this has to do with what you also share with us, that millennials and aging baby boomers want what cities today have to offer? So a lot of the brain movement is into these cities, and they are really excited about redoing Detroit or Chattanooga or Indianapolis, what have you. Tell us how much the demographics and economic forces are playing into this.
Well, I think demographic preferences have shifted across a broad segment, not just in the United States, but outside the U.S., and people want communities that are of high quality and where they can live, work, and play. But I think there's also a level of economic restructuring going on where the economy, and particularly the innovative economy, is being driven by networks of universities and mature companies and startup and scale-ups and entrepreneurs. And, you know, when you have, a network economy, what you crave is proximity and density and vitality, which basically describes cities. So it's the combination of profound demographic and market forces that are basically reviving and regenerating the cores of our cities and counties. And, you know, once you have that kind of concentration effect, you know, you also naturally have leaders and stakeholders from multiple walks of life trying to get stuff done.
We'll return to this episode of America Trends in just a moment. If you like what we're doing here at America Trends Podcast, please don't keep it to yourself. I know there are a lot of people, John, who think, well, if I'm listening and somebody else wants to listen at the same time, maybe we're going to collide and they're not going to be able to hear us.
Yeah.
Is that the way the technology works?
No, there's plenty of bandwidth. Everybody can listen at the same time.
All right. Well, that dispels that myth. Now, you can do a number of things that would really be helpful to us. You could give us a kind rating or a review at Apple Podcasts, and that boosts what they consider to be our value and visibility. And what does that do, John?
Well, that puts us in the forefront so that you can find us easier, and most important is other people can find us easier.
And you can subscribe there or on our site, americatrendspodcast.com, or wherever you're listening, so we can alert you to new episodes of the podcast, which, by the way, we put out twice a week on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And stay in touch with us on both Facebook and Twitter at Trends Podcast. Or you can like us on Facebook or follow us where, John?
On Twitter.
On Twitter. Yeah. That's right. Where the world turns to hear fake news or whatever it is. Well, you can direct message us at Trends Podcast or using hashtag Trends Podcast. And you know, John, with our growing audience, and really it's been pretty remarkable, a lot of people just came to us the last month or two, and they might have missed earlier episodes. Can they get them again?
They can look through them and pick the ones they want to listen to. They're all on the website, and a lot of them are up on iTunes, many of them.
All right. Well, listen, there's lots of material to listen to. We hope you have the time, and we'll lend it to us because we try to make it worth your while. And thanks so much for listening.
And tell your friends.
We now return to this episode of America Trends.
Explain to us, you say that the populism that defined the 2016 presidential election shares much of its origins with the new localism, and yet one deals with grievances, the other with problem solving. Put that together for us.
Well, you know, there have been profound forces, particularly around globalization, that has led to large economic insecurity. In not just the United States, but really all across Europe and the mature economic world, people are worried about their own livelihoods, you know, and the potential for their children to move ahead. So populism is a way to exploit grievances. It allows for the entrance of demagogues in many respects. I mean, look at the Brexit vote in England, in Britain. which very much was a response to economic insecurity and cultural anxiety. New localism basically is a way to solve problems. It's a much more pragmatic response. It takes the same set of issues and says, well, let's roll up our sleeves and get stuff done. It's not enough just to complain about things. You know, or to get people, you know, sort of whipped up in a frenzy. That doesn't really resolve the problem. It just leads to more political instability. So I you know, to some extent, new localism and angry populism have the same parentage, but they're responding to it in radically different ways.
You remind us that power and problem solving locally is not an argument against the vital importance of the federal and state government. And tell us, in this era of Donald Trump, block grants, diminished federal rulemaking, will this accelerate the new localism in some manner?
Well, to some extent, the federal government in the United States has become a health insurance company with an army. So, you know, which to some extent reflects the role it's supposed to play. It's supposed to be a safety net for the disadvantaged and for the elderly. It's supposed to protect the homeland. It's supposed to provide some common rules and regulations around the enforcement of civil rights and market behavior. So, you know, the federal government actually has some fundamental roles that can only really be played at that level. But as the discretion and fiscal freedom of the national government begins to diminish and their ability to actually make progress on hard challenges, you know, what we're going to see is the elevation of the city-state as the vanguard of problem-solving here and abroad. And that's, again, because, you know, cities are networks. They're not governments. They can't be hijacked by partisanship or ideological polarization. They really have a large number of leaders and citizens who cross, you know, multiple partisan lines, who wake up every day and really just want to make their place better. It's very concrete. It's very specific. It's very tangible. And the rewards for making your own place better really reverberate and amplify.
Take us to Pittsburgh, if you will. A lot of people may have left Pittsburgh at a point where it was steel mills and a lot of activity in that regard that fell away. What's happened there as an example?
Well, you know, Pittsburgh, the bottom literally dropped out in the late 1970s. And what happened is that corporations, philanthropies, great universities like Carnegie Mellon and the University of Pittsburgh, and great political leaders at the local, county, and state level filled the vacuum. And they said, we're going to have to invest in the future. We're going to have to be the best at what we do around next-generation technology. So they invested in centers of excellence around, frankly, technologies that no one even believed in at the time. Robotics, artificial intelligence, big data analytics, machine learning. We didn't even have names for these technologies 40 years ago. But that's what Pittsburgh began to invest in at scale in a sustained way. And they've become essentially an innovation playground. And, you know, everyone who needs to be around talented faculty and students, you know, whether it's a Google or whether it's a Disney, you know, or Uber testing autonomous vehicles, they have to be in Pittsburgh, not because the city or the county or the state are throwing tax incentives at them. They have to be there because that's where the knowledge is. The other thing about Pittsburgh is, you know, it has the effect of the magic square mile. Carnegie and Mellon and the University of Pittsburgh were built next to each other in the Oakland neighborhood. And again, it reinforces what I talked about before. The market wants proximity and density. In order to sort of speed and accelerate the invention of new products and the commercialization of research. You know, Pittsburgh is like an early 20th century geography that's been completely revalued in the 21st century.
As much as you said this is going on globally, and you do focus on Copenhagen, you also suggest that it's a greater phenomenon here in the United States. Explain that.
Well, I think in the U.S., there's always been a collaborative effort in many cities and counties across sectors. You know, I go to many cities in the U.S. and see the mayor or the county executive, and it's not unusual to have the head of the local philanthropy or philanthropies, the heads of the universities, key employers, key business association. There's sort of a natural way in which the sectors co-govern and co-produce the economy and solutions in the U.S. You know, outside the U.S., there's more of a distance between the sectors because the public was expected, the government was essentially expected to be the problem solver. And therefore, there's a bit of suspicion and a lack of trust across sectors. But I think one of the resilient elements of this country, of the United States, and the reason why, you know, we can still be, you know, not just growing as an economy, but really inventing new ways of solving hard problems, is because we have a multiple sector and multiple discipline approach in many of our places. It's built into our DNA. And so even when Washington, like Elvis, has left the building and literally shuts down from time to time, you know, we have these networks of institutions and leaders that are putting shoulder to the wheel and getting stuff done.
Yeah, life
goes
on.
That's a huge strength of ours.
I know you talk about new localism as being much more than government, and you tell us that it can mean multiple geographical levels that we're talking about here, districts, cities, counties, metropolitan areas. But is there anything about the form of governance in a Chattanooga or Cincinnati or Kansas City or St. Louis that they hold in common, or can this happen even in places where you have partisanship in terms of D and R after the elected officials? Does it have to be on a certain level or scale, or can it be smaller cities as well?
I think it can happen at many levels, and, you know, we talk about in the book of cities that, you know, have Republican mayors like Oklahoma City that are making signature investments in the rejuvenation of the core of the city, as well as, you know, cities and counties with Democratic leaders who are doing the same. I think there's more shared commitment to place at the local level, because again, you're rewarded for pragmatism and you're punished for obstruction at the local level. You know, at the federal level or the state level, which again are hyper partisanship, you tend to be rewarded at times for obstruction because you adhered to party ideology or to the party line. And so I don't think these partisan divisions matter as much when you go to the local level around the issues that we're talking about. We're primarily talking about investing in the future, investing in our children, investing in infrastructure, investing in the growth of entrepreneurs and commercialization of research. You know, once you go to the local level, the partisan divide on those issues tends to break down.
You tell us that the new localism is propelling lots of things, including economic growth, and you explain that in terms of what's going on in Pittsburgh, new styles of governance. But the one that interested me most as to how the new localism is contributing to this is finance, cities on the front line of the next economy. How are they demonstrating that?
Well, again, we take our readers to Copenhagen, because we think Northern Europe, not just Copenhagen, but cities like Hamburg and elsewhere, have invented a new kind of infrastructure finance. And the difference between the Northern European cities and American cities is the Northern European cities know what they own. American cities only tend to know what they owe because of pension fund liabilities. But when you know what you own, you know, waterfront property, areas around the downtown, former industrial properties, you're able to value them, and ultimately you're able to leverage them for large-scale redevelopment. And then what the difference in Copenhagen is they've created a public asset corporation, a corporation that's publicly owned and professionally managed that holds all these public assets. And the revenues from sale or the revenues from leases goes to fund a state-of-the-art subway system for the entire city. In the U.S., we tend to have either privatized management at times or just kept it totally within the public, like the New York Port Authority.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, you don't get the same kind of professional management and depoliticized kinds of investments, and you definitely don't use the revenues to fund a major infrastructure investment like a subway system. In the U.S., we tend to use taxes to do that, as opposed to, you know, the revenues from land sales. So, you know, my view is that there is public wealth in the U.S. that has yet to be identified and ultimately leveraged. And, you know, there's a lot of talk about investing in infrastructure. This might be the path to do it, building on the success stories of the Northern Europeans.
Well, Bruce Katz, thank you for being with us today, you and your co-author, Jeremy Nowak. The book is called The New Localism, How Cities Can Thrive in the Age of Populism, and you basically sum it up this way. Power now belongs to the problem solvers, and I hope they have at it. We need a lot of problems to be solved in our society today, and if other levels of government have not found the formula, fortunately, many on the local level have, and you have brought that to our attention. Thank you so much for being with us today on America Trends.
Thank you so much for having me.